Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, brought to you by Money Magazine, creating financial freedom for Australians since 1999.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for another episode of Friends with Money, Money Magazine's podcast to help you earn, save, and achieve your financial goals. My name is Tom Watson, a senior journalist here at Money Magazine, and as always, it is a pleasure to be with you. I've got to say that I am always fascinated by the intersection between money and psychology, but it's one of those topics that, you know, we probably don't talk enough about on Friends with Money and more generally. Having said that, dedicated listeners may remember episode 68 when we had a chat about the dangers of retail therapy, and maybe a more recent episode as well on financial goal setting, which was episode 147 off the top of my head. Of course, those are both excellent episodes and well worth checking out if you haven't listened to them already. Today, we are going to continue on this theme with a discussion touching on everything from analysis paralysis to overconfidence and sunk cost fallacy and the relationship between those and how we approach our dealings with money. Plus, we'll get into a technique designed to help us be more effective with decision-making more broadly, but also when we're dealing with our finances. So to help us dive into all of that and more, I am very pleased to say that joining us today is psychologist, executive leadership coach, and author of the newly published book, Productivity Joy, Simi Rayet. Simi, welcome to Friends of Money. It is a pleasure to have you on.
Hi, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
Simi, to start us off, would you like to perhaps give us an elevator pitch about your book, Productivity Joy? You know, what's it all about? And perhaps just as important, what inspired you to write it in the first place?
Yeah, Productivity Joy is about a system, a reliable system that's backed by psychological science that takes 5 minutes a day to help you feel energized and be effective for your day. It's something that I found myself at a time of my life 4.5 years ago where I was stressed, overwhelmed, at the brink of burnout. And I remember very specifically this precise moment living in the UK in a 2-bed flat with my little family in the west end of London, arriving home a Friday evening, opening the door, and I could see socks and shoes and bags and toys all the way down the hallway. And I could hear all this joy and laughter coming from the TV room. And I was furious. I was exhausted. I slammed my bags down and I'm walking down the hallway and I opened the door to the TV room. And my kids and my hubby stopped what they're doing and they looked up at me and they said, "Oh, here comes the bull." Now, that was a real wake-up call for me because although, yes, they still love me and they loved me dearly then and they love me dearly now, the reality was because I was so stressed and overwhelmed, I had become not a joy to be around. And those closest to me were taking a step back. And I knew something really needed to change and that change needed to start with me. So that's when I realized that although I'm, you know, working as a psychologist, helping so many of my clients who are also feeling this struggle and in this consistent juggle, I wasn't applying the tools and techniques for myself. And that's when I started to do quite a lot of research to see what was out there that could potentially help people, busy people, set their day up for success in terms of their mindset, their emotions, and attention and behaviors. And this is where I started to really play around with key questions that we can ask ourselves and the impact and the influence that they have on our brain chemistry, how we feel, and how we show up. And this is where the 5Qs formula was born.
Well, I think we're going to get into the 5Qs formula in a little bit. And, you know, just anecdotally, I think that story that you just told us about your own experience is probably going to be so relatable to to a lot of people listening. Obviously, we're going to focus on the money side of things today. So, Simi, you know, how are people's attitudes towards money formed? You know, do they tend to happen early on in someone's life, or do they gradually develop over time? Is there any kind of set formula, or is it different for everyone?
It is different for everyone, but you know, the common thing here is that money, our attitude towards money, can be shaped by a combination of early experiences. So childhood experiences, our social influences, personal beliefs, and also psychological factors. And often these are happening, these attitudes are formed subconsciously over those years, and they can significantly impact our financial decisions, our habits, and our overall well-being. You know, for example, you know, if you're observing your parents' or your caregivers' behavior around handling money, whether they were savers or they would spend impulsively or even discuss financial stress, this, you know, deeply influences children's views on money. You know, for example, if your parents, you know, are frugal, children may grow up valuing saving money, whilst, you know, there could be a household that's more focused on material purchases, and they could have a belief that money is more for spending. So those parental behaviors are really play a part in terms of our decision making and how we think and feel and our relationship with money. And then there's also emotional associations. So, you know, if we've had financial hardships, we've lost money, we've had conflict over money, or even receiving money as a reward, all of those things can attach an emotional weight to money. And when we attach an emotional weight to money, it's really linking money to a sense of security, love, freedom, and stress.
I'm glad you brought up the you know, topic of emotion there, Semi, because that's exactly where I wanted to kind of move the conversation. I guess I'm interested in knowing more about what you think it is that, you know, can make people so emotional when it comes to dealing with money, but perhaps in ways that they might not be when dealing with, you know, other issues and other parts of their life. Is there anything kind of behind that or unique about money that makes people feel that way?
Well, I think because money is, you know, or the exchange of money is deeply linked to our sense of security, identity, self-worth, and even love. So, you know, at the basic need, money is linked to survival. It provides us with food and shelter, healthcare, all the other essentials. And when money is scarce, it triggers this deep primal fear around safety and security. And this fear can create anxiety, stress, or even panic. But then you've also got financial instability. You know, if we lose a job, you know, made redundant, we lose a job or in debt, this can create a real sense of vulnerability and insecurity. And, you know, this fear of the unknown or not having enough can also be overwhelming. And then you've got things like social status. You know, money is often equated to success, status, and power. And, you know, a lot of us, even though we might not want to admit it, we do care about what other people think of us as well. And money can be quite closely linked to feelings of shame or inadequacy if we feel that, you know, we're not measuring up to some of those expectations that we had for ourselves or that others have of us as well.
So moving on from I guess, the emotional side of things there, Simi, one of the other, you know, parts of, I guess, how people look and deal with money that I'm interested in is the role of bias, you know, things like confirmation bias, overconfidence, sunk cost fallacy. You know, the latter is something that people probably have heard of or may be familiar with, you know, in association with, you know, their dealings with finance or money. Obviously, some people won't be familiar with those terms. So could you give us an example or a couple of examples, totally up to you, of how these biases can play out in relation to how we deal with money, how we deal with our finances?
Yeah, so there are different types of biases that come into play here. You mentioned confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is essentially when we seek out information that confirms what we already know. Now, our brains really dislike ambiguity and not being in the know. So our brains will very quickly default to things that we already know because it keeps us safe. It keeps us in the know. So there may be some potential beliefs that we hold unknowingly or knowingly around money. For example, you know, we may have a belief that, you know, investing in the stock market is really high risk. And we may then make a decision to invest, but as soon as we know that we've, you know, made a bit of a loss, we go, oh, I already knew that. So why did I do that? So we're always seeking out this confirmation bias to try and prove ourselves correct. The sunk cost fallacy is another cognitive bias that you mentioned. And this is where people, you know, an example of this could be where people continue investing their time, their money, or effort into something simply because they've already invested a lot into it already, even though there's no longer a beneficial or rational reason to do so. So the sunk cost refers to any kind of past investments that cannot be recovered. And the fallacy bit really lies in the irrational belief that we must keep going with it to avoid wasting any of those past efforts. So you kind of just keep investing or you keep going, knowing that actually you're not going to make a return, but it's easier to keep going because of all that time and effort you've already invested. A different example could be, you know, staying in a bad movie. Imagine that you've paid for a ticket to go see a movie and 30 minutes into it, you realize that it's terrible, you're not enjoying it. And instead of leaving, you decide to stay because you've already spent that money on the ticket. And that's, you know, an example of the money is a sunk cost. You can't get it back whether you stay or leave. And then the fallacy bit convinces you to stay on, endure the unpleasant experience, just so that you feel like you've got your money's worth.
That last part is so relatable to me. I'm sure it is to a lot of people out there. I was just kind of like ticking off a list in my head of all the times that I've probably done exactly that. So yes, probably a bit of learning that I can do from that. Simi, I've waited a while to ask you this, but it's obviously a core part of the book. So can you please tell us about your 5 Q's formula? You know, what is it all about, and how can it help people, I guess, in this, you know, setting of finance and money, make better decisions?
Yeah, so the 5 Q's formula essentially is asking yourself 5 core questions at the start of your day. Now, the start of the day is a really wonderful time to prime your mindset before you get distracted by social media, emails, all the other things that life throws at us that can take our attention and course off in a different direction, in a direction that is not really meaningful or purposeful to us. Now, the 5 Q's formula is backed by psychological science, and each question has been curated to tap into your emotions, your thoughts, focus, attention, and behaviors. And a great way to remember, you know, what those questions are about is through the simple acronym PRIME. And I'll just briefly share what the acronym stands for, because it'll give you a sense of, you know, what each of those questions are about and why we're asking those questions. So the P stands for pinpoint your emotions and your feelings. Now, I'm not asking you to, you know, have a therapy session with yourself in the morning. This is essentially just acknowledging and paying attention to what emotion or feeling you are experiencing at the start of the day, because that acts as a baseline for how you want to, if you choose to regulate or shift that emotion throughout the day. But we need to pay attention to it so it doesn't, you know, overtake us or intensify during the day. The R stands for recognize gratitude. Now, traditional gratitude practices get you to write down a list of all the things that you're grateful for. And, you know, whilst that can be helpful, this particular question asks you to, or it cultivates more of a deeper sense of gratitude, which increases your serotonin levels, which are your feel-good, happy-good neurotransmitters, and also the dopamine levels in your brain, which is your motivation neurotransmitters. So in a way, this particular question is giving you that natural dopamine boost at the start of your day. The third one then is the I, which is identify things in your environment that could be working better for you that day. So things that are working well and things that could be working better. And what this question does is it actually helps you hack your natural brain's natural hardwired negativity bias. We all are hardwired to look out for threats and harm and things that are potentially negative to us or could have a negative impact on us. So what this particular question does is it actually hacks that negativity bias and gets you to look out for positive things or things that could be improved. And what, you know, when you do that at the start of your daytime, it then creates this domino effect that you then start to notice other things throughout your day that are working well. And it builds this momentum. It gives this sense of progression, progress, and fulfillment. And then we move on to the M, which is make a list of three high-impact tasks that you're going to focus on that day. Now, you're probably thinking, oh my God, I'd normally have more than three tasks that I've got to do in a day. It's like a long laundry list. I completely get that. But having a long laundry list of to-do, things that you need to do, can really feel unsatisfying and unfulfilling because most of us are continually working really hard to tick off that list, but we never get to the bottom of it. Not because we're not working hard and we're, you know, being busy and trying to do things. It's because there's always so much to do. So this part of the formula gets you to really identify what are the three things that are going to truly move the dial for you in your business, in your personal life, or in your work. And there's a chapter dedicated in the book that really helps you identify what your three things could be for a given day. And then each day when you do that, there'll be a different three things that you focus on. And then we have the E. The E is for envision how you want to show up for your day. And I love this question. This question is at the end of the formula for a reason, because it helps you to remind yourself of your values, your superpowers, so the things that you're really good at and that you enjoy doing, and your energy. And it's helping you make that really conscious, intentional decision of how you want to show up for your day, the tasks, the interactions that you are going to come across in your day. And it helps you take accountability. So you asked me the question, you said, well, how can this really help then the 5Qs formula with, you know, our decision-making or how we approach our finances and, you know, our money mindset? I think, you know, very often because money is so much so driven by emotions, it's hard to make clear, rational decisions when we're feeling stressed and overwhelmed and we're scattered. But if our attention is focused and we're very intentional about what we're trying to do, what's important to us, our emotions are balanced and calm, it's so much more easier to then approach your finances. So the 5Qs formula takes essentially 5 minutes to go through those questions once you know them. And that can help you to be so much more intentional, calm, present, and connected with whatever you do that day, even if it is looking at your finances or making some really significant financial decisions.
Sumi, as you were talking about creating lists there and narrowing in on lists, I was looking over the table at my massive Friday priorities list, which is a smaller part of my larger weekly list. And I was thinking, oh, geez, this could definitely be cut down a little bit further. So I totally get your point on that one.
Yeah. And you know something, Tom, you know, if you did that every day, the three high impact tasks over a week, 15 high impact tasks that really move the needle are done. And then over a month, wow, like 60 high impact tasks are done. Like that's a real sense of satisfaction, fulfillment, you know, progress. And I think often we're really critical on ourselves, and without realizing it, these long to-do lists can really grate at us and make us feel that we're just not progressing or we're not doing enough.
I can completely relate to that as well. I think just thinking about finances very quickly, I can think of probably at least 5 or 10 bits and pieces that I know that are in the back of my head that I need to kind of narrow in on, including checking my insurance settings and in my superannuation, and putting in some of my recent investments into my little spreadsheet, which I just haven't done, and canceling a credit card. Jeez, there's just one I forgot about that. So you know, this could be a long list that could be narrowed down a little better to approach it more effectively. Simi, I'm conscious of time, so two very important questions before I let you go. First of all, where can people get a copy of your book if they're interested in reading more?
Yeah, Productivity Joy is available in all good bookstores across Australia. It's available directly to buy on Amazon and also from my website, which is simireyat.com.
Fantastic. And if people are interested in following you on social media or obviously on your website, where can they find you?
Yeah, I'm very active on LinkedIn and Instagram, and always very keen to hear from people who are using the formula to see how it's helping and benefiting them. And also, if people have questions around the practice and how they can apply it into their daily lives, more than welcome for people to get in contact with me and through the website as well.
Brilliant. Well, Simi, thank you so much for joining us today and for providing some seriously interesting and useful insights, which I'm thinking about already. It's been a fascinating chat and a pleasure having you on the show. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a real pleasure.
That's it for this episode of the Friends of Money podcast. But don't forget to jump on our website, moneymag.com.au, for your daily dose of financial news. Or you can go grab yourself a copy of the latest edition of Money Magazine in all good newsagents. As always, Friends of Money will be right back in your podcast feeds next week. So until then, my name is Tom Watson. Goodbye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Friends with Money podcast. For credible, independent, and easy to understand financial commentary, visit moneymag.com.au. Please remember that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are general in nature, and further independent advice and research based on your personal circumstances should be sought before making an investment decision.